I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. A lot of what you thought you knew about poor black kids growing up in Baltimore may not be true. A research effort by three sociologists who got to know 150 African-American young adults who were born into public housing and exposed to significant violence finds that most of them didn't turn to crime themselves, and that many kept themselves on track by finding something to be passionate about. But that still, despite the promise many showed in school, very few have gotten a college degree and a firm hold on a middle-class life. We'll talk to sociologist Catherine Eden of Johns Hopkins, one of the authors of Coming of Age in the Other America, on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Today we're focusing on young adults in Baltimore, some of the most vulnerable young adults. In the national media, we hear lots of stories about the millennial generation, people born in the decades leading up to the early 2000s. We hear stereotypes of them being self-involved, unwilling to commit, that they work to live rather than live to work. That's a different set of stereotypes than we hear about young adults in Baltimore, for the most part, who are often seen as not respecting authority or law, not willing to work for their goals. Those stereotypes are not what three sociologists found over an intense decade of getting behind the stories of 150 young African Americans who were born into public housing projects and raised amid significant violence. The sociologists found the young adults showed tremendous resilience, and for the most part, they sidestepped getting pulled into the drug life. The researchers spent hours with the young people, interviewing them at different points and analyzing their responses. The result is a book published in April on the anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray, titled Coming of Age in the Other America. It was researched and written by Stephanie DeLuca and Catherine Eden, both sociologists at Johns Hopkins. DeLuca is associate professor and Eden is distinguished professor of sociology and public health. And Susan Clampett-Lundquist, associate professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. And Catherine Eden is here with me in WIPR studio. Welcome back to Midday.
So glad to be here, Sheila.
So what did you find out about these young adults that you didn't expect? What surprised you?
You know, in some ways, I would almost answer that as everything. So we met these young people in the early 2000s when they were in elementary and middle school, and we talked with this was about 5 to 7 years after they had entered into a federal experiment that sent some of them on a course where they would move out of public housing into more mixed income neighborhoods, and others who would remain in public housing. So we met them as young people, and very young people, and we talked a lot to their parents. We observed them in reading and math classes, and when we came back then in 2010, it was to find out what had happened. And, you know, the conventional wisdom at the time, I think especially if you follow the media and media on Baltimore and television series like The Wire or The Corner, led us to expect that these kids would be drug involved, that they would be pursuing a set of lifestyles that were really deviant from the mainstream. And I remember saying during the summer of 2010, we first came back and began reengaging with these young people, which we would continue to do through the end of 2012. Where are the drug dealers? We saw people who were young people who were, of course, we did have some drug dealers, right? That would be really odd if we didn't. But young people who were so committed to a conventional future, Brittany, who wanted to be a dancer, Bob, who just wanted to get married and live in a little house in East Baltimore and raise a family, perhaps, you know, as a manager of a GameStop. We met young people who wanted to be nurses and accountants. So they were so much like the young adults you meet everywhere. In ways that I think were sort of stunning and endearing, especially given the neighborhood and family context that these kids had come from.
So that's really not what you were expecting when you laid out this research project?
No, you know, it's interesting. I don't think that we had a prediction per se. The nice thing about following a sample prospectively is you can watch sort of trajectories unfold over time. So a lot of studies will say, oh, we're going to study drug dealers, right? They kind of choose the outcome and then they go find the people. So an example of this would be fellow sociologist Alice Goffman's book, On the Run. It's really about drug dealing. And so you go and find the drug dealers. Despite the fact that these books are wonderful books, it sort of leaves the impression that everybody's a drug dealer, because you're not sort of looking at the array of trajectories that end up unfolding over time.
Well, it struck me, and even after reading the book, I'm not sure I've actually put these two double strands together, the double strands that run through Coming of Age in The Other America. On the one side, how moving out of neighborhoods of very concentrated poverty improved the lives of quite a few of the young people whom you interviewed, but also how that wasn't enough to make them really successful.
Yep. So that's it's a poignant story, right? What happened in Baltimore in the late 1990s and into the 2000s is that some of these families got into this federal experiment called Moving to Opportunity and spent some time in mixed-income neighborhoods as a result. They got vouchers they could use on the private market. But many other of these families were subject to public housing demolition. There was a significant wave of public housing demolition in Baltimore during those years, so that we saw a 70% reduction in the supply of those units. Those families oftentimes also got vouchers, and they often used those vouchers to move into more moderate poverty neighborhoods than the extremely high poverty neighborhoods. You know, Baltimore has really seen a positive transition that's seldom talked about. Prior to this demolition, we had about 35 high poverty tracts, extremely, extremely high poverty. But after demolition, we saw, and because of other changes in Baltimore, we saw a significant reduction in the supply of those kinds of neighborhoods. So what we show in Coming of Age is that many of these kids, many more of them, were living near employed people, had neighbors who were two-parent families. One of our young people said, you know, they call it a nuclear family. And she was talking about the contrast between her old and her new neighborhood. And we do credit this with giving these kids a real sense of hope and the future. But as the book, and we also, you know, I'm sure we'll get to talking about the identity projects eventually, but what we see then in the last part of the book is that continued stress from the family of origin. These are extraordinarily poor families, and the mother's circumstances didn't improve. They didn't. They weren't more likely to get jobs and so on. So
let me interrupt you. Hold your thought, but I want to make sure we understand that. When you say the mother's circumstances didn't improve, you mean even in the families which moved to incomes of less concentrated poverty, where there were just sort of better dynamics in the neighborhood, the mother's circumstances did not improve. Why not?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Many people who were living in public housing in the mid-1990s, when all of the families enrolled in this study, if you could get out of public housing, if you were sort of able to escape public housing, you probably would have done it by then. So oftentimes you see women who, mothers who've had extreme exposure to trauma, parental drug use reported by both parents and youth was high. High school graduation, extraordinarily low.
College this is in going, the parents'
in the parents' generation, right? So this was a group of families that was so disadvantaged that in some ways we needed to wait a generation to see the tremendous transformation that these neighborhood changes would bring. Now, I will say that mothers do report feeling much less stressed. Their health improves quite dramatically. We know that from the survey that went along with the qualitative study. Hypertension, obesity. So it is not as if neighborhoods don't have their impact. But in terms of poverty alleviation and, you know, dramatic gains in human capital, we really don't see that in the parents' generation. But it's manifest in the kids.
This may explain then something that I think is on page 29. You wrote that most of the families ended up moving back from, when the families who moved to neighborhoods of less poverty ended up moving back into very poor neighborhoods. And I couldn't figure out why.
So the families that got the special voucher, who were part of the experiment, and not just the families who moved because of demolition, they had to stay in a neighborhood that was less than 10% poor for at least a year. Now, it turns out that to find an apartment in such a neighborhood is no easy feat. So they ended up in sort of two kinds of neighborhoods. First, they ended up in neighborhoods that were on a trajectory to becoming poorer. So it was literally...
So they stayed in the same place, but it became a poor neighborhood.
Correct.
I see.
Correct. And we can all imagine what those neighborhoods are, Northeast Baltimore and so on. Other neighborhoods, like Columbia, Maryland, just... I mean, what a contrast to living in Lexington Terrace, right? But oftentimes, transportation became a nightmare. The kinds of family networks that have been developed over generations for survival became harder to access. And so people, families did move back to those resources over time. Now, they still maintained an advantage over where they had been, a pretty substantial advantage. We're talking about neighborhoods that used to be 60% poor, and families ended up in neighborhoods that were about 27% poor. So quite an improvement, but not the 10% poor neighborhoods that I think the program's architects had hoped they would be able to remain in.
It's Johns Hopkins University sociologist Catherine Eden here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the book on which she collaborated, Coming of Age in the Other America. Are you part of this generation she's describing, young adults who started life in tough neighborhoods? What do you wish people understood about your life? You can join our conversation by calling us 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. I cut you off. You were about to say that what we saw in terms of mothers, the parents' generation, not really being able to take advantage of a lower poverty neighborhood was not true of the kids.
Yes. So with the kids, we do see in the survey work as well as our own work, this intergenerational leap forward. I mean, if you know, this book is so hopeful in some ways. There's if you compare the percentage of kids who use drugs versus the parents' generation, the percent of kids who are going to college. You know, 70% of our high school graduates in this study have enrolled in some sort of post-secondary education. Stunning. 13% of their parents had done that. You look at single parenthood, you look at other forms of sort of conventional behavior, and you see that these young people are so ready to be invested in, right? We gave them a modest improvement in their neighborhood conditions, and they flourished in ways few of us would have expected.
That's a great point, a great place for us to pause for a minute. We need to take a quick break, and that's a pretty powerful point to think about. When we come back, more with one of the authors of Coming of Age in the Other America. In the Other America. And your questions and comments, you can call us at 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about young adults in Baltimore, kids who began life in public housing projects and for the most part, figured out how to keep themselves on track, out of trouble. The research we're talking about is called Coming of Age in the Other America, and I'm talking to one of the book's three authors, Catherine Eden, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Public Health at Johns Hopkins. You can join this conversation. How does this sound to you? Are you one of these kids who had this experience, or have you seen it nearby? Do you have some thoughts about it? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Coming of age in the other America. The other America is what?
So just over 50 years ago, a book was published, famous book by Michael Harrington, political scientist. It was called The Other America, and it shook America to its core because it pointed out that even in the post-war, you know, decade of prosperity, there had been this rise in poverty, and it was hidden, not very well hidden, especially in African-American neighborhoods, but almost right under our noses in this period of prosperity. There was another America that people weren't talking about. And many people credit the publication of the book, The Other America, to a transformation in the trajectory of Bobby Kennedy and then of Lyndon B. Johnson, and really leading to the rise of the war on poverty. So that's kind of the trick of the first part of the title. The second is in the coming of age, of course, is Margaret Mead's famous book about adolescence in Samoa. So it's a bit of a riff on certainly two of my favorite books.
Well, millennials are often tagged with the failure to launch syndrome. Young adults who wander through college and then they end up back in their parents' house without really an idea about what kind of career. It may be an unfair stereotype, but it's attached pretty firmly. What you found with these young people in Baltimore is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, so
they're eager to launch.
They're almost too eager to launch. So you know, this literature on the emerging adult does sort of portray this Peter Pan, Neverland existence. Mm-hmm. And we were just stunned to the degree to which our kids were really not on an emergent path, but an expedited path. You know, and in some ways, this really led them to sort of downplay their dreams and pursue more expedient paths that didn't get them.
Give me an example.
So someone who aspired, you know, since the one of our young women, just a really gifted young person as a student, she nursed her sister when her sister was dying of AIDS. So she was in junior high at the time, and she really dedicated her life to the goal of becoming a nurse. So, good student in school. Everybody expected her to pursue this job, you know, this dream of nursing. Yet when she gets to the 11th grade and the 12th grade, family pressure is mounting, right? She needs to get out of the house and get her life going. You know, one young person described the family of origin as almost clawing at her like crabs in a bucket. You know, all of that disadvantage just clawing, and this leads young people to say, "Oh my, you know, I don't have time to get a 4-year degree in nursing. I'm just going to go and get a degree as a nurse's aide, and then I'll be in the field working with people, satisfying my passion to help others, you know, in just a few months' time rather than in 4 years' time." Of course, the problem, right, is that the nurse's aide job is, yeah, I often call it one of the worst jobs in America, because you can seldom get full-time hours. You're paid close to the legal minimum. Every time a patient dies, you lose hours. So these young people end up, you know, launching almost too quickly. Or they'll apply, this is especially true with the for-profit trade schools, which were the most common the most common place where our young people enrolled. They really know how to market to these young people. They show pictures of graduates, you know, with high-speed boats cruising around the Inner Harbor, and they portray, you know, lifestyles of wealth, really. And our kids kind of say, gee, why would I go to community college when I can go to for-profit trade school? And many times what happens is the go. I remember one young woman wanted to, ended up going to be a phlebotomist, and immediately discovered that she couldn't stand the sight of blood. Well, she didn't even know what a phlebotomist meant. It sounded good.
And something medical.
Yeah, something medical. And she wanted to grasp that dream. But unfortunately, we found tremendous exploitation in the post-secondary labor market. It's almost like, you know, these schools preyed on these dreams and provided a product that, even if kids graduated, and of course they seldom do, they failed to make a living wage, and they were saddled with tremendous debt.
Because the for-profit trade schools tend to be more expensive than community college.
They're much more expensive.
And the credit, there's not a way of transferring credits if you decide that you can't stand the sight of blood when you've signed up for a phlebotomy course.
Yeah, so you can't then shift to physical therapy or to become a medical technician. Now, some trade schools around the country, community colleges, are building models that allow you to do this. So that's exciting, but there are not very many of them. So you have these sort of silos, you know, you go down one path, and we all know when our kids go to college, right, they start out wanting to be a doctor, go to medical school, and they take a sociology class, and their trajectory also alters. So many two-year programs really don't offer that kind of flexibility where you can sort of, you know, these young people, like all young people, are in a process of discovery. And if you are trying to chart your final course at 18, your chances of being wrong are pretty high.
You had pretty intense conversations with these young people. How much of the decision that some of them made, some of them who would be or could have been admitted to a four-year college, how much of the decision that they made not to go that route was just because of the violence they'd seen? Life just doesn't seem long enough to invest 4 years preparing for a career.
Great question. Two of the young people, when we met them in 2003, in both cases we said, these are the kids that are really going to succeed. One named Bob, the other Brittany. Now Brittany was in the ninth grade when I first went over to her house in Dundalk. They were living in Dundalk at the time. And she was just electric, you know, long braids, beautiful. She'd figured out a way to get herself into a dance academy, a charter school. She had devoted her life to dance. It was everything to her. She was a brilliant student. In the ninth grade, this particular charter required her to take the PSAT, and she scored so highly that she was named a national achievement winner, which is, you know, run by the National Merit Organization. So she said to me, her and her mother and I, another interviewer, Siri Workington, sat around the kitchen table for hours talking about her hopes and dreams. And she was determined to go to Harvard. I remember, and I was actually teaching at Harvard at the time, so this was like very exciting, you know, for her and for me. I remember her and her mother had developed a chastity belt dance. You know, so she was so focused on not getting pregnant and getting through. But shortly after that interview, she was sitting up in her room studying one afternoon, and she watched as two of her brother's best friends were murdered in front of her eyes. And it could have happened to her brother. He happened to have to bring a cousin to the hospital after an accident. So
he wasn't there.
he wasn't there, but he should have been, and it could have been him. Then shortly thereafter, she was talking to her boyfriend on the back porch one night, and this is after they've had to move back to East Baltimore because they've gotten evicted, and she's so actually pretty close to where I live now is where this happened in East Baltimore, and a man was shot, and he was just walking along the sidewalk, stumbling along the sidewalk, bleeding, and she walks as she calls an ambulance, this begins to just drag at her. Suddenly, it's not so easy to get to school. She has to take a bus and a couple of buses. It takes her about an hour and a half each way to get to school. And this becomes harder and harder. It's almost like, you watch the air being sucked out of this girl. She scrapes by through graduation. And of course, with good grades, but it's touch and go as to whether she's going to drop out because she's just so. Her brother's in a lot of trouble with the law. He actually ingested a lot of lead paint as a kid. The family actually got a settlement because of it when she was really young. So he had a lot of problems inhibiting his behavior and was always in trouble with the law. The long and the short of it is rather than go to Harvard, she enlisted in the Army. And, of course,
she ended up not applying to any colleges.
No colleges.
Right?
She applied to no colleges. And, she's still a fighter. You can still see this joy and life in her. She is on track. She's getting a trade credential and she has a job and she's doing her best. She did get pregnant. And she's just had her second child, so life is hard. You still see the spark. She's on track, but she's not who she could have been.
And that's an amazing story. Well, let me just remind people they're listening to Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Catherine Eden. She's one of the authors of a new book called Coming of Age in the Other America about young adults in Baltimore, some of the challenges they've overcome and some that they haven't overcome. Some people may be listening to this and with all due respect to the intensity and the time you spent interviewing, how confident are you that you were able to pick up the true stories? I mean, for example, you have some statistics about, I think, as I recall, over the course of the time you were talking to these young adults, only 18%, I think, ever even flirted with illegal activity, and most of them didn't stay in it very long.
Right.
How sure are you of that?
So I think we need to think about knowledge as a continuum. We never really get to the truth, I don't think, as researchers, and it's important to have humility about that. Surveys, of course, just ask folks. And you're telling a stranger something. We knew these families and kids over 10 years' time, interviewing them repeatedly. And then we selected a subsample to follow very, very intensively in a very informal manner, hanging out and just kind of inserting ourselves into daily life. So these layered results, I think we're probably certainly we know a lot about these kids. Did we miss some illegal behavior? Sure. But it is interesting how eager they are to show themselves and to show you who they are and.
So you're pretty confident that...
We're pretty confident, yeah. We have a few young people who we couldn't interview because they're incarcerated. So obviously,
Not everybody stayed on track.
Not everybody stayed on track, but most did.
One of the things that Coming of Age in the Other America has gotten a lot of attention for is what you found out about what you call identity projects. What is an identity project?
So this will make sense to every listener who is ever an adolescent. And somehow, I don't, you know, it's this was the most striking part of the research. In what predicted, you know, the literature, right, research has all kinds of sort of speculations about what will determine who stays on track and who doesn't. So, but what is not really in the literature are these key things that young adults, young adolescents really cling to that offer meaning and identity. And it turns out that when we were trying to predict who stayed on track and who didn't, identity projects were the strongest predictors. So what's an identity project? Mm-hmm. This is a core set of activities that give meaning and identity to young people and connect them to the conventional world. So some identity projects are, for example, Vicky in West Baltimore held on. This is how kids hold on long enough to be on track, given the significant risks in their families and neighbors. You know, what gives them the psychological strength to keep going, to exhibit grit and determination? So some are like Vicky and her pigeons. You know, we're talking with Vicky, we're doing the interview, and it's clear Vicky really wants to show us something. She wants to tell us about something we're not asking about. So she bursts into the conversation. She says, "Hey, do you want to see my birds?" And we go into the backyard, and it's like this whole world that she and her father have built. And her dream is to fly pigeons all over Baltimore. You know, so that's one example. A second example would be, you know, Vicky's identity project doesn't connect her with a community, but Bob's does. So Bob is, you know, he ends up getting into Poly, which your listeners know is a very competitive test high school. But his family begins falling apart. His mother and his father break up. His mother begins using cocaine, and he ends up flunking out of Poly. So he gets sent to this this high school, his zoned high school in the east side of Baltimore, and he's really not doing well until one day he turns on the TV and discovers Pokemon. He is obsessed with Pokemon, and then he finds a group of like others in his high school who are interested in punk rock and in goth and in card games, Magic, The Gathering, and this provides this community for him and also provides a way of dressing that says to the drug dealers in his neighborhood, "I am not you. Don't mess with me. I'm about something else." So that's kind of an intermediate identity project. But the most effective identity projects are ones that connect you to a set of institutions. So Cody joins the police explorers at his high school. He is so proud to be part of the police explorers. He has a little, like an amulet on a necklace that he wears, like a badge of honor. And he says that when cops see him in the neighborhood, they say, "Hey, you're a police explorer. I'm not going to mess with you." So it's almost like a shield. And Cody,
and I can
really
see why you call it identity project, yep, because I can see how that's each of these kids, it's an identity, but that's one that could actually take him someplace. We need to take another quick break here. We're Catherine Eden is staying with us for the hour. She's one of the authors of a new book called Coming of Age in the Other America. The power of kid getting passionate about something. Have you seen this in your own life, in your kids? Well, why does it happen for some kids and not for others? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Catherine Eden, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Public Health at Johns Hopkins, about the research that went into her latest book, Coming of Age in the Other America, published by the Russell Sage Foundation, co-written with Stephanie DeLuca and Susan Clampett-Lundquist. You could be part of this conversation. What are you hearing that makes sense to you? What do you think, what changes could society make that would make better connections for these young people? We'd be interested in your ideas. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. We were talking about identity projects. Are they mostly do-it-yourself? I mean, are they mostly kids come up with themselves? I mean, that's what we sort of see throughout society is kids, some kids get passionate about something.
Yeah, so, you know, this is something that we've really began to underinvest in America. You know, if you think about budgets for arts programming in schools or about things like the Police Athletic League, community level youth resources, we need more and more of these, and if you look at the trajectories of cities, you see that we offer young people less and less of them. So ideally, we would like everybody to have some institutional home for their identity project, because it's like getting on a train that's already on the tracks, right? It connects you to resources. So Cody goes to these camps all over where they compete, right? And it's very all-consuming. But he's also got a connection. He wants to be a police officer. He's got a connection to the how-to of how you become a police officer. He's interested in firefighting as well. He's got connections to people who work in those kinds of trades. So we'd like to see more of this, but we do see a tremendous amount of do-it-yourself. I think in part because our investment in the arts, maybe in particular, in drama. Bob gets into an Afrocentric theater company in his church, and his youth pastor and the kids rewrite Shakespeare plays to be of relevance to urban Baltimore kids. And he stars in several of these plays, and it's deeply meaningful, but very few kids had access to that kind of resource in their communities. So you see a lot of the do-it-yourself kinds of things that Vicky was engaged in. And I think the tragedy there, right, is that people like Vicky become deeply isolated. We really do
need
each other.
She's in the backyard with her pigeons.
She's in the backyard with her pigeons, and it's something that connects her to her father, mm-hmm. which is a relationship. But it's a form of withdrawal. You know, she's in one of these for-profit trade schools. She begins in one trade, and she's actually using the ladies' room, and she goes through a portion of the school that's training people to do HVAC. And she's halfway through another program, and she's like, oh, this is what I really want to do. She's got good technical skills, right? She mm-hmm. enjoys the building of the pigeon coop. So, you know, she has to kind of regroup and start over and accumulate more debt in order to facilitate that transition. But she is deeply isolated, and many of our kids have to choose between community and isolation. And the way you stay on track is you choose isolation.
Because that way you won't get distracted or pulled
yep.
into bad behaviors. I want to mention, we were talking a few minutes ago about problems kids have with the for-profit trade schools. We did a show earlier this year about the report that the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition released. It chronicled some of the same issues that you've talked about. And we will re-link to that. That show is on our website, but we'll make sure that it's easy to find on the website if anybody wants to revisit that conversation about for-profit schools. Mark has called us from Baltimore. Mark, welcome to Midday.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
And I just, I should say good afternoon. I apologize.
You're very welcome, whatever you call it.
I just wanted to ask or maybe get a comment on. I work in the city. I work with a lot of 20-somethings, maybe 17, 18-somethings. And one of the things that I've noticed, and it's a real stark contrast, I grew up and lived in western Howard County and that part of Maryland, which is a lot different, obviously, socially as well as economically. And one of the things that I really have struck me is some of these young folks in the city don't have a driver's license, don't have a dream of getting a driver's license. And I feel like especially the kids out in the suburbs tend to have this freedom that they have, and it gives them a certain amount of responsibility to adhere to. And I just wanted to get your comments on that.
Mark, thanks for the call. Catherine Eden?
So as you can imagine, very few of the parents have cars. You know, it's one reason why we did have some families move out to Howard County. And sometimes that stuck, but sometimes it didn't because of the lack of public transportation. Public transportation is a huge problem here in our city. It not only adds to the length of kids' commutes to work, but the unpredictability means you have to leave hours in advance, and if you have to work a late shift, you might find yourself walking home. So I think all of us who study these communities, lament the end of the dream of improving public transportation in the city, and we continue to hope for that. But I understand what you're saying. Why would you get a driver's license if you have no hope of having a car? You know, and this is another thing that high schools used to invest in. I did driver's ed in high school. Everybody took driver's ed, and you got 6 hours with an instructor for free, and the taxpayer footed the bill, and you went in, and when you turned 16, you took your driver's test, and that was part of the conditions for a course. So maybe even another example of how we've kind of privatized getting a driver's license, and as you also know, it's pretty tough for a young person to get a driver's license in Maryland as opposed to other states. We have more rules and regulations than some other places.
The point of this research, I think, was primarily to look at these young people and not so much contrast those who had a certain MTO, moving to opportunity voucher, that took them out of high poverty neighborhood versus some other way, but really to compare them with their parents. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about parenting from this?
Well, it's interesting. Here is an example of where actually the change in neighborhood did yield a transformation in parenting. So the literature holds that people have different parenting styles, and middle-class people parent in ways that, advance sort of creativity and freedom and openness, and lower-class parents, but they really push their kids, and lower-class parents are sort of laissez-faire. We found it, when we first started this and we were in the housing projects with these families, we did see some laissez-faire parenting. You know, parents... as I said, parental drug use was quite high. You know, this was the crack generation, the parents' generation. But there was also a sense of such deep despair, just descriptions of what life is like in Flay Court homes, which, of course, is now, where Albemarle Square is, right by by Harbor East in Lexington Terrace. I mean, walking over bodies on your way to go to the grocery store. That many parents say that in the projects they had almost given up, and kind of given their kids over. One really striking feature of this research was to watch parents gain efficacy over their parenting as they moved. One parent said, in the projects I felt, and I quote her, trapped, caged, and worthless. Once she got out of that that environment, she said it was like moving from night to day. She talked about listening to birds chirp and how remarkable it was to see greenery. And
because none of that existed in the old neighborhood.
None of that existed in the old neighborhood, no. And many of these parents also described changes in their parents. And we were watching this. We saw this because we observed. We don't just talk with people. We observe people in their homes. Suddenly, like a light switch is on, and you're advocating for your kid at school, right? You're getting your kid into that charter even though you missed the deadline. You're on that kid to do his homework. In ways that you weren't before, and so, although the literature sort of holds that these styles are fixed, what we found is that a transformation of someone's neighborhood environment could often be exactly what was needed to flip the switch from a more laissez-faire kind of parenting to a more engaged, involved kind of parenting.
So, does that lead to policy recommendations? Is there something you think society could do?
You know,
to leverage that kind of parenting?
Yeah, so we are now the most economically segregated as Americans than we have ever been in our history. So we actually are getting worse rather than better in terms of getting people into neighborhoods with more of a mix of incomes. And that's really, really crucial. Now, Baltimore, as I said, has had a somewhat different trajectory in that regard than the rest of the country. But it's still too segregated. We know that. We just drive around the city. We can see that. And nationwide, there has to be a call to action. So the quantitative results, the survey results on the young people in their mid-20s show that even these modest gains in neighborhood quality lead to huge declines in teen parenting, single parenting, marked increases in labor force participation in earnings. We've got to become less segregated economically. We've got to start reversing this intensive pattern of sorting by place that income inequality is really brought to this country. And we have to recognize that as one of the most urgent social problems of our time.
We have just a minute or so left, and I want to spend it on grit. You mentioned grit a few minutes ago. Grit is sort of a buzzword these days. It came up. We had a conversation 10 days ago about soft skills, teaching young people soft skills that would be useful in the workplace, and grit came up as a soft skill. But you write, one of you wrote on page 145, grit is not enough.
Yeah, so it's important. It's necessary, but not sufficient. So what we find is that identity projects are crucial for generating grit. You know, the way the literature on the grit reads, you think, oh, you either have it or you don't. You can either delay gratification or you can't. And what we see is within-person changes in kids as they get identity projects. We see the generation of grit. The problem is in these institutional traps that we've created in the post-secondary labor market. So you get all these gritty kids who are pouring their dreams into one of these, frankly, exploitative for-profit institutions where they leave with no credential and a wave of debt. And you've eaten their grit. You've wasted their grit.
It's a fascinating book. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Walking us through it. Coming of Age in the Other America, published by Russell Sage Foundation, written by Catherine Eden, Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Public Health at Johns Hopkins, our guest today, along with Stephanie DeLuca, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins, and Susan Clampett-Lundquist, Associate Professor at St. Joseph's University. I also want to thank the DIS for supplying lunch today for midday guests. DIS is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington, features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes, on the web at thedisbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow, the food we waste. As much as 40% of the American food supply is thrown away each year. Why is so much food going to waste? And how? What effect does this have on the environment? Make sure to tune in tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.